Do we have any kernel developers here in the room that I don't know, that are not yet on the stage? Anybody contributed like 5 patches in the past few months or something? One patch is not enough, but a few patches would be good. No? Okay, maybe then we're doing with the crowd that sits on the stage already. So, welcome everybody. This is a traditional kernel questioning. I don't know how often it's been done on the Linux talk before, but it's been done for like at least 5 or 6 years, I think. We have a few kernel developers here on the stage, and the idea is they first introduce themselves, and then the audience can ask them questions like whatever you want to know about kernel hacking or life of a kernel hacker. And I'm really looking forward to your questions. Normally, this session would be done by Niels Magnus, and I would be co-moderating, but Niels is had to jump in with the security contest on that's running on the open source area at the moment, so I'm doing it myself today. So let's start. Can you please introduce yourself and what are you known for in the Linux world for what work?
Yeah, my name is Robert Richter. I'm working at AMD and mainly at or do implementations for the perf subsystem and also sometimes a little bit implementation for CPUs, AMD CPUs, bring up from new CPUs.
Oliver Neukomm from SUSE, USB and some power management.
Jörg Röder from AMD too. I work on IOMMU stuff and on KVM stuff.
Yeah. My name is Hans-Jürgen Koch. I'm a kernel maintainer of the UIO, user space IO subsystem. And yeah, I'm working on that. And, yeah.
My name is Wolfram Sang. I'm working for Pangotronics, which is a company doing mainly embedded Linux. I'm the maintainer of the I2C subsystem for the embedded drivers. And well, I work on all kinds of subsystems which you need for board bring up, so lots of buses like SPI and whatnot, and the board bring up itself. So I it's lately a lot of ARM-based stuff these days. That's what I work on.
Hello. Oh, yeah, cool. I'm Alexander Graf. I work for SUSE and Freescale. I'm the maintainer of PowerPC KVM, in case anyone of you heard of. Probably never used it, but it's a really cool thing. Just give it a try. I also maintain lots of user space things in the QEMU world, emulation of mainframes, of PowerPC again. And what am I known for? Basically, in that whole virtualization community, as the guy doing all the weird stuff that nobody else wants to do. So, if you look at things that you kind of consider useless, that's me.
Alasdair Kurgan working for Red Hat on Device Mapper and User Space LVM.
One more question for all of you, maybe this time in the other direction. What have you been working on for the last like 6 or 12 months that might be of interest for those that's sitting in the audience right now?
Well, there are two or three things. The main thing that we've been doing on the device mapper side is what we are calling thin provisioning. It has lots of different names, and people get confused. But what it means is delayed allocation of storage space. So pretending you have more disk space than you really have, which is very useful if you are running virtualization, you have various servers, and a lot of those servers could share the same images, so you want them to share the same disk blocks. If they're all reading the same data, why do they all need a separate copy of it? When you want to back them up, you want to take a snapshot of that efficiently. So we've been improving the snapshotting code and doing this thin provisioning code, and I think that's the main thing we've been working on. in the last year.
Cool. So on the KVM PowerPC side, I've mostly been working on I've mostly been working on hypervisor accelerated PowerPC KVMs, so on Power 7, for example, or on your power station in case you own one. You probably don't own a Power 7 system either, so that won't help. But on those machines, you could finally run, if you run Linux bare metal, you can run KVM fully accelerated on those machines. Otherwise, it would always have to trap and emulate quite a bit. The same goes for embedded PowerPC systems, which even less of you guys probably have. But on those, we finally support EtherFunMC, which is also capable of doing hypervisor accelerated things. And that's mostly it for the kernel side. On user space, I've been working on getting user space emulation for ARM going better, since in the build service, in the open source build service, you're building the whole distribution through emulation. And there were lots of race conditions and weird corner cases that some packages during building were triggering, where we just couldn't build the packages without fixing the emulation layer.
I've been working on bringing new Freescale system on chips into the mainline that are quite popular CPUs. So unlike your devices, you might probably have one or two of them in your pockets without knowing. It's quite some work to get a new system on chip into the mainline kernel, and we assisted in doing that. But not only did we provide support for new system on chips, the ARM world was recently yelled by Linus because of being too chaotic and everybody doing his own stuff and not maintainable. And there has been a huge consolidation effort to bring stuff together to handle it centrally, and lots of effort has been done into that, so we get a more slim kernel, which is maintainable in the future, better maintainable in the future.
Yeah, and recently found a problem in my in the UIO subsystem concerning mapping of memory. At the moment, it is possible to reserve memory with kmalloc in the kernel and then map it to user space. And that is a thing that can be critical because mapping is always done in full pages. And so if somebody in this kernel driver reserves 20 bytes of memory and maps it to user space will have access to an entire page. And since that memory comes from the slab allocator, it is possible that other drivers use other parts of that page. And from a user's point of view, that is simply a risk that if your user space part that uses UIO, if that goes wild, the kernel can suddenly crash in a completely unexpected manner with completely useless error messages. And the problem is, I'm working on that, but it'll be. I discussed it with quite a lot of core kernel developers. And it's still not really clear. I can fix it in the UIO subsystem so that it is not possible at all to do that, but that might not be the right solution. It's probably right to say that it should be impossible to map kmalloc memory to user space. At the moment, it is like that at least you cannot unmap it again. That's the fun part of it, and nobody ever noticed that. It's still not really clear how to solve that problem, but that's what I'm working on.
So. I spent most of the last year working on the driver for the version 2 of the AMD IO MMU. When you were on my talk today at 2 p.m., you heard about it. The IOMUV2 is basically about easier data transfer between user space processes and hardware devices. And this required some experiments and a lot of work to get everything running as it should.
Does anybody know who this is? Anyone?
Pick up the phone, they will tell you.
Putting it in the corner. Remind me to put it back later. So continue, please. Sorry.
Besides that, I spent some time reviewing and merging other IOMU drivers, especially from the ARM side. They are also pushing with their own IOMU hardware and have drivers for it, and this was a lot of work.
USB 3.0 and the XHCI chip and getting this to do suspend and resume correctly.
Yeah, as I said, I'm implementing hardware monitoring support for AMD CPUs. So if you use the perf subsystem with performance counters, then you're using probably code that I've wrote. Especially the most highlight of my work is that with kernel 3.5, the instruction-based sampling, which is a performance monitoring unit extension for AMD CPUs, went upstream. So there's kernel support now for this, which means that you can that you have precise event sampling, which means that you get the correct address from an event or which was the source address for a certain event that you trigger. And another kind of work which is related to performance monitoring is the NMI handler and the x86 architecture. Because most of performance counters are using, or mainly only performance counters are using NMIs. So I did also some rework in that part of the kernel.
So, any questions from the audience? Come on, give it a try.
Actually, that's a question for all of you, ideally, to be answered by everybody. What do you think is the biggest challenge in kernel development? And I don't care if it's a personal challenge or the challenge you see for kernel development at all, including all the developers.
I think it's being patient with the maintainers to get the code upstream. So you have to listen to or to the maintainers what's the way how they want to have the code getting changed. And yeah, and you have to discuss it technically on this level. So that's yeah. What we observe, where many people fail actually.
I've got a feeling that the rate of change in hardware recently has become faster, so it's getting more of a challenge to get the drivers out in time.
Challenge I see is that the amount of code contributors increases, which is nice to see. People are contributing code. But that creates a huge amount of patches which need to be reviewed, and the amount of reviewers does not scale the same way. That's what I see. And this, on the one hand, leads to that it might need a longer time to get a patch into the mainline kernel. Patches might get lost, dropped, so you have to ping more often to the people which are under a heavy load. This is a challenge because you can't really only jump in and say, yay, I'll start reviewing. You can do this with like formal changes, but the review process is something which has to do with trust. So as a maintainer, if you pick up patches and somebody reviews the patch, you have to have some trust to the reviewer, and this needs some time to build up. While amount of code, lots of people put code onto the mailing list. Some is good, some is crap. So that's the easier part of that. And I think it's a challenge to get that into shape again, so the process will be as fluent as we want it to be.
I think scalability, as the hardware gets better and faster and smaller and cheaper, it's if you think CPUs, we're going to get more and more cores, potentially hundreds of cores could become commonplace on systems. That involves a lot of change to the way the kernel and any other code does things. And just keeping up with this sort of scalability, changing the way we do locking and so on to work in sort of massively parallel systems, while at the same time the kernel's still working well on, you know, other sorts of devices like it does today. I think that's quite a challenge for everybody. And you know, we're only really beginning on this road. There's a lot of change to come there.
I'd also like to add in that that side that we also have new tasks where the kernel is more and more used. I mean, some years ago, the kernel was only used on servers or desktop PCs. Also, now we see it more and more on mobile devices. And even if that also is happening since a few years, there's still a lot of work to do regarding power management, especially. We saw that with the Android approach, where they did that behind closed doors, their solution, and which was not accepted for mainline, and that is still some work in progress. It's not only to prevent the device from suspend in certain cases and allow it to suspend afterwards, but also one wishes to have more granularity. For example, that you say in your smartphone, okay, I allow these and these and these drivers go to suspend, but I want to have to wake up on each interrupt of the GPS device, for example, because I'm tracking a GPS track, something like that. So, some years ago it was just a decision, can I go suspend the whole system or can I go or don't? And even for a laptop today, that is still the normal thing. If you don't do anything after 20 minutes, it shuts down or something like that. But on the smartphone, you need that every few seconds and require very fast waking from sleep. I think that is still a challenge.
Ich? Yeah. from time to time, it's challenging for me as a kernel developer to keep up with what's going on the mailing list and at the same time getting your own work done. So this can be challenging from time to time. To either you lose track on the discussions that are going on, and or you get your code done and out. So this is from time to time this is a challenge too.
Alexander? You're the only one that didn't say anything, so.
I'm not sure if I really got the question properly, and you know, everybody answered to a completely different facet of the whole issue. Let me look at the last one that I'm aware of, technical one. So if you come from user space and you want to dive into kernel space development, and you know, you go in with your usual habits, oh, you know what, I'm just going to allocate 10K of stack space and throw something in there, and let me just, you know, allocate 1 gigabyte of memory. It's going to be sparse. I can just poke some holes in there. Either way works. All that stuff doesn't work in the kernel. You really have to look out what you're doing. You have to take locking seriously because of the scalability issues. You have to take. You basically have to do memory management on your own. There's so many things that just make things more tedious than they would be in user space. But from that, working on the kernel is about the same as in any other project. Big project, to say.
Thank you. More questions from the audience? There must be something you want to know. There's somebody. A daily sports now.
Let's assume I wanted to start developing something for the kernel. What do you think first would be the best starting point to just get a grip of things, just to learn how things work in the kernel? Is there some specific subsystem where you would say, look at it, look at the code, and just try to understand how it works? And the second thing is, I'm under the impression that there's not that much traditional documentation around the kernel development process. There's the kernel development book, and there are some driver books, and I think that's it. Do you have some recommendations for documentation, for books, for tutorials?
May I? Okay, cool. But maybe simple thing, the first question, what's the first question again? Damn it. Don't do two questions once, it's too much for me, really. To the latter one, that's really easy, kernelnewbies.org, check it out. It basically describes all the process, how to get a patch in, how to, you know, who to contact. There are scripts in the kernel that tell you if you write a patch, who to CC on that patch so they actually know what you're doing. That one is actually documented reasonably well once you know the URLs to poke on. The other one, the question on what subsystem should you look at to work on, that's really easy to answer, the one you're interested in. So if you have an issue, if you, for example, if you have a webcam that doesn't work, look at webcam code. If you have, I don't know, if your hard drive does weird noises, check out what's going on there. It really depends on your use case. Usually, the best way to learn things is in being interested in it. So if you have something, some need where you think, damn, my device I have lying around here for 10 years just doesn't work and I really want to get it rolling, sit down, look at things that are similar, and try to get it in. It's really as simple as it sounds.
But there is something to add. If you're looking for a good example, then pick something recent but not brand new. So there is old and crafty stuff. You probably will go insane if you try to understand the floppy driver or the SCSI subsystem in its entirety. So, and at the same time, if you're looking at the staging driver, you're probably going to pick up the errors, not the good stuff. So I'd say something recent but not brand new, like fairly simple, would be the input layer. Just an example, there is other stuff, but it would be a fairly useful suggestion.
For a starting point, it maps a bit about what, when you're interested, for example, in memory management, you can really expect that the code there is not as understandable as in other parts of the kernel, which won't come as a surprise, I guess. So I guess you have a bit of a feeling which is more complex and which is less. Besides that, I really go for the you have an itch, scratch it. That's a motivation thing. And about documentation, I know there's a documentation subdirectory in the kernel tree, which is of varying quality. But there is in that directory, there's a subdirectory development process. And that is a set of chapters written by Jonathan Corbett, who does the LWN magazine. And this is a really good and quite recent introduction into the kernel development. And this is definitely worth reading.
Maybe to get your first kernel code, it would be the best to implement your own driver. So this is the best starting point. You could load it then as a module also, and you even don't need the hardware for this. So this would be another option too. Maybe this would be also interesting in question how we started, or what was the first thing we wrote for the kernel, and for me it was a driver, so was some sort of driver. It didn't went upstream, but it was the first I wrote for the kernel.
My joystick did not work because my sound card was PCI, which was brand new at that time, and there was a clash in the resource reservation code. And that patch went upstream.
My first project involving kernel code, which never went upstream but still exists as an out-of-tree project, was a little driver for no particular hardware, but it was a tunnel driver which allows to tunnel Ethernet packets over IP to switch two networks together on layer 2 and not on layer 3. Good if you want to play old IPX-based games over the Ethernet.
My first driver that it actually made it into the kernel the very first thing I did was I had for my laptop a PCMCIA TV card which was not supported. The chip itself on the card was supported, but it had used some GPIOs to turn on power and for the tuner, and the tuner model was not supported. And so I fixed that, and in the end, that was just it was a few weeks' work, and it involved some hardware. So I had to make it open with a scope, check the GPIOs and things like that, and after that, just made it work. And found out that this tuner type was actually compatible with some supported tuner. After that it was easy, and in the end it was just a 5 lines patch or something like that, but it made it to mainline, and the card was working afterwards, and that for me personally that was the greatest success. It was the greatest 5 lines of kernel code I ever did, and especially the experience I made, that I just sent the patch. I didn't know how to do a patch properly at the time. I think I called diff with the files in the wrong order, so it was a reverse diff. But the maintainer was Gerd Knorr at the time. He was very kind and said, "Oh, I fixed it for you," and applied the whole thing. And so after a few days, I had that in the official kernel tree, and I was the happiest man in the world. And that was the motivation for me to continue to do more stuff in the Video for Linux subsystem. And I did the first I2C driver for the radio data system chips. It's also in mainline now. And I keep that in mind now. And I think a lot of maintainers, most maintainers, will tell you similar stories. And hopefully. And I think most of them keep that in mind if some new contributor comes with his first patch. I mean, you often read things, and it's often true, that we have a very harsh tone on the kernel mailing list, but that's not really true. That comes really from, like Wolfram said, there are so many patches to review that you just have to be brief. You cannot be have no time for unnecessary politeness. Sometimes it is like that you read it and just write no and send it back, you know. And if that is somebody who is used to it, then he'll know how it's meant. But I don't think that any kernel maintainer is really an evil person, you know. So just please don't hesitate if you have a patch. And even if you think your mail client doesn't handle it properly, or you don't know if you did it correctly, send it. Nobody will eat you.
My first kernel contribution was the extension of an I2C driver, which used to be just tied to old ESA-based cards and then was used in another context. So I had to adapt the driver because I didn't know anything about that. I had a look at another driver and as a reference, and I found some flaws in there too. So I came up with a set of patches which really made it mainline, which also made me very happy. And yeah, that was, so my first connection with the kernel was the I2C subsystem, and now I'm one of the maintainers of it. So that's quite typical, I guess.
My first kernel patch, which I actually have never even sent upstream because it was completely pointless, was to implement a syscall that you would call from user space to inject a keyboard press into the kernel. Pretty easy thing. I had a remote control that had a user space daemon called lurk, which could read the numbers on that remote control, and I had a daemon running then in user space which would go in and create a T9 style, not T9, like the keyboard presses that you can emulate using the 9 digits on a phone. So you press 1-3 times and it's a C. Yeah, that one. I implemented that one in user space, and somehow I had to tell the kernel to press that key now, because I was using mPlayer at that time and wanted to control mPlayer to forward or quit or like type in file names. It actually ended up working in at least when not running X. But I never even sent that one anywhere.
Alistair, what was your first patch? Do you still remember?
I can't remember.
Okay. So we have one more question from the audience.
The problem was that I had to build the Intel embedded media graphics driver for a kernel it was not meant for. And I had to adapt many of the functions to make it run. The DRM init function, for example, changed. And some macros, spin log initialization changed, for example, and things like that. The question is there a way to easily track changes that have to be made to drivers from kernel version to kernel version without being a specialist in this area? Many people have to adapt their drivers to new APIs, I guess. So is there a way to track these API changes?
The drivers should be mainline, and then the conversion will be done automatically.
Yeah, this is not what Intel does, so what should I do with it?
Complain.
There's no other way to
it. It's a pretty simple thing. The general rule of thumb is whoever changes an API changes its users. So if your code is upstream, it's really simple, right? Whoever changes the APIs changes your code too, so your code still keeps on working. Once you're outside of that ecosystem, there's nobody there to help you. That's the sad story, really.
A starting point, maybe, the kernel newbies or .org website has, with every kernel release, a quite good list of what changed with the new kernel. And there are also API changes mentioned, so that would give you a rough idea what happened. But I think if you skip or want to jump a few kernel versions, that still might be result in some work. But I can't think of anything better now than... You could use the Git history of the repository to see what happened to the in-kernel drivers regarding the API changes and stuff like that.
Okay.
While on the topic of graphics drivers, two of you are working on patches or functions that are, make it possible to make drivers in user land, like user space IO, and you work with the IO MMU things you mentioned and the other things from your talk. Is it possible, might it be possible one day that NVIDIA can do that drivers in user space, or is that completely a stupid idea that will never happen in the foreseeable future? It's something that people always expect from these technologies.
Drivers in user space have a kind of fundamental problem with power management. Like, the user space is necessarily frozen before you do the PM callbacks to the driver. And that's not fixable, basically. So this means that there is a basic limit on what you can do in user space. They are very, very busy to extend this. They even got DMA working, and I'm impressed. But still, there is a limit, and for the time being, it's probably remaining.
I have even a bit of a problem with using the term driver in user space. In user space I/O, we often discuss that thing. In the kernel term, the terms the kernel developers use, a driver is something that is in the kernel. And so, for example, in user space I/O, the small kernel stub that we need, that is the driver, and the user space part is okay. I usually use user space part of the driver. It's not a nice term, but it's best I can think of. And the idea behind it is, and that is something that that needs to be explained. The kernel developers try to do things in user space if that is the best solution and if it's completely possible in user space. Otherwise, it has to be a kernel module. But things that can be easily done in user space, if we would put them into the kernel, the kernel would just grow bigger and bigger and bigger. So it makes sense to do things in user space if it's possible. But on the other hand, the Linux kernel will never be a microkernel, in the sense like other systems do that. It's a monolithic kernel, and so the functionality of user space will always be limited. So there are things that cannot be done in user space, and what he mentioned, power management, for example, is one of these things where it at least would become absolutely complicated and ugly.
Speaking about graphics drivers in particular, today huge parts of the graphics driver stack already run in user space. So command queuing for the GPU, for example, to tell the GPU how to render a certain 3D picture is all done in user space and sent through the kernel to the GPU. I also don't think that it is possible to do a graphics driver completely in user space, because what a complete user space driver can't do is to multiplex the GPU between different processes in a performant way. So, and as it comes to the kernel part of the graphics drivers today, do exactly that. They multiplex the GPU between different processes using the GPU.
If you take the longer view, then we have put more and more of the graphics stack into the kernel. With an original VGA card, the driver was indeed fully in user space. And perhaps we have some X developers here who can, they talk about how great kernel mode setting is, and they probably know what they're talking about. So.
Next question from the audience.
Yeah, I have one comment or probably question. You mentioned you should mainline your driver if you want to have it maintained by the kernel maintainers or whoever changes some API, but I'm mostly active in the embedded arena, and we are often developing drivers for pieces of hardware we actually build ourselves and which will never ever be used by anyone else because you can't buy it, you can't get it without our company. So the question is, do you have any opinion how those drivers should be maintained? Should we really mainline them? I mean, they will just blow up the kernel.
That can easily be answered. I can tell you in 2008 at the Hannover Trade Fair, there was Andrew Morton, Alan Cox, Greg Croer Hartman, and that was the first time I met Greg. He's also a UIO maintainer, and I asked them exactly that questions, and the others were listening. And I said, in UIO I often have kernel drivers where I know that the hardware exists only in that company. You cannot buy it anywhere. It's of no interest whatsoever to anybody else. And they all said at the same time, bring it to mainline. That is definitely the best way, and Greg he's the driver core maintainer, and he has it in all of his talks, one big sentence, yeah. all drivers belong to the kernel org tree, and that's what you should do. Send your patch. That is no problem.
I mean, we are talking about hundreds and hundreds of drivers here. If we take the whole embedded industry,
yeah, send them.
Okay. Think about it. That it's even if you can't buy the hardware, it's still a sign of how a certain infrastructure in the kernel is used by some drivers. So what are people interested in? And that gives an idea of, well, look, they try to tweak, or people are trying to tweak around us. There's a demand for doing this. Can we do this in a more elegant way because people need it? Stuff like this is also, this is why drivers can be helpful, although you can't buy the hardware, just to see what people are doing with Linux kernel.
Okay.
See, a part of our job is to simplify the internal APIs. So if we find that an API apparently is not used, we will try to remove it, and then you have a problem. So if in doubt, upstream.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, sometimes it would save us money to put it upstream. That's clear.
Disk space is cheap. Put it upstream.
So, more questions? Here, moment.
Hi, I was wondering, before you get me wrong, I love C, but there are a lot of languages that keep you from doing really stupid mistakes, like C++, for an example. And there is this old discussion how this would work with the kernel. So what's your point on that, to move to languages that kind of protect you a bit more, or are a bit more, yeah, safe to use for some people?
No.
Yeah, that's the short answer. I already also know the answer that there are a lot of stupid people who apparently use these languages according to Linus, so this is not an option too, but that's kind of unsatisfactory.
The answer. Kernel code requires us to have full control over our memory allocations, and it basically requires a very specific way of doing locking, which very much ties us to the C language. I mean, you probably could write a C++ module, but then you would have to re-implement the full memory management. And you couldn't use the goodies like exceptions because of the locking. So we will put in more library helpers that are easier to use. But basically, if you were to use a language different than plain C in the kernel, you would more or less reduce that language to plain C. There are languages where strings are nicer to handle, but if you're doing a lot of string manipulation in the kernel, then you should consider what you're doing wrong. So,
when you write an operating system kernel, you want to be as close to the hardware as possible, but you don't write assembler. And the C language in itself is, how to say it, an advanced macro assembler. And so it's, I think, the best choice to write an operating systems kernel, and there's no real reason to use any higher level languages, which only bring you more away from the hardware you're writing your code for.
And if you mention quality, the kernel quality assurance is very much done through code review. And it's done in a quite successful way. When the kernel has now more than 15 million lines of code, and we have very stable releases, and millions of people rely on it, and it works. I think it's one of the most successful projects in big projects in this regard, and. If it's done in code review, what's the difference between languages? I mean, whatever the language is, you can write buggy code in every language in the world, And C is a very well-defined language. You also have to remember that the kernel has to compile on 32-bit, 64-bit systems, little endian, big endian, on two dozen and more architectures. And at the moment, I don't even know any another language that could do that.
Another thing is also, you have in the kernel already frameworks for complex or solutions for complex questions, for example, list handling and so. So you don't, this is not necessarily the language, it's more the framework itself or what you have available for programming. And new developers often make the mistake to implement their own thing before looking at what is already there, and there are nice solutions which are also of high quality. So, but yeah, it's not that much the choice of the language. So, but I would say the main thing is that C is probably the best language in the world for this. So, and it just makes it fun to program C. So. We never want to change this. There's no reason for this.
Linux is now 20 years in existence, and it has always been tied to that language. So there's a very, very deep interconnection with that. I would expect serious problems when you try to refactor that, even core parts into another language. If you're really convinced that another language might be the better choice for an operating system, or if you want to try and play, I have the feeling it might be better to start from scratch. Maybe you should use a Linux driver model somehow so you can at least have the drivers, but obviously those are the parts which are in most cases buggy and might take most advantages of the protection areas you want to have, but then you have to rewrite 15 million lines of code, more or less.
I mean, did you have a specific language in mind, to be frank?
Well, yeah, for example, C++, because it has its root in C, and it's evolved a lot since it started, granted. I wasn't claiming that it would be better to use that. I was just wondering what would be the implications of changing subsystems or adding different modules written in such a language. So apparently it's not possible, if I get your opinion right.
I just wanted to inject that, in my opinion, the kernel is more object-oriented and cleaner in this regard than most C++ code I've ever seen.
But the point was that C doesn't give you these features, so you have to re-implement everything. Sure, you have this implemented now, but if a language would already give you these features, then you could benefit from the syntactic sugar or whatever. But, okay, thanks.
You're all kernel developers, but you're all also using Linux. Are you happy with how user space is developing these days, like systemd, upstart, or GNOME 3 and Unity? Or do you think that's getting too complex? Any opinions on that?
It more features mean more complexity. That is inevitable. What we are forgetting sometimes is to make this controllable. Like, if you've really ever tried to use, for example, the dbus interface for Blues without the graphical tools, you know what I'm talking about. This should probably improve.
Anyone else? Do you like systemd, or it's something that's, Linus complained about GNOME 3 and systemd, there's always sometimes people complaining.
I'm not complaining here, just a development I tend to see recently is that people tend to break up layers. So in the, like, until a couple of years ago, there was always a really strict layering between everything. There was like, you would have your file system that would run on, like, for example, device mapper, and then it would access your disk storage, which again would, for example, if it's MBD, would access things through the network protocol and so on. It would just all be very cleanly layered, and we're trying to slowly eliminate those layers in several areas, like ButterFS does in that example, or like systemd does for logging, booting, and whatever else it does, which does not necessarily have to be a bad thing. It's always a question of trade-off on how modular do you want to have things to be, and how complex would it be if you don't do the modularity enough. And I don't know if we actually reached the answer yet. It's definitely a good thing to try it out, so to just rethink a few things that are happening these days. I'm not sure if the desktop rethinking thing is exactly my thing, but it's certainly good to try things out.
What I like about the Linux ecosystem is that it's so highly configurable. So if people want to spend days on getting their window compositor or something to work, then they can do that. I prefer not to, so I can replace that setup with a simple tiling window manager and have my shells and be happy. And that's a huge, huge power of Linux. And so far, I see that the upstream, the main distributions get more and more complex, but so far there are still enough people who like to avoid it and write proper tools so everyone can go his own way. That's what I'm happy with.
Well, there is a lot of diversity out there. One of the developers in my team doesn't use a GUI. He's quite happy with a console and just has multiple virtual consoles and does all his work there. Text, web browser, fine.
In my opinion, the question is what Linux should try to be. Should it be the old hacker system from the 90s, where everything is more Unix-like, or does it want to be a more mainstreamish desktop system, for example? And when it wants to be a real competitive desktop system, Linux has to be compete with other desktops and with other state-of-the-art desktops, and this obviously means more complexity with all the new features. And I think to get around to systemd, that systemd and upstart are parts of this increased complexity, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
Oliver?
Well, but still, it is important that we keep the basic ability to use the system from a text console. So some new development like Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, practically not usable without a GUI, is not a very good development. So there should be something done. But still, we have more features, and yes, complexity will grow. And especially what systemd says, system 5 in it carries its age in the name. And that does not mean that I'm fully happy with the replacement, but there is simply no denying that sometimes old stuff will have to be scrapped.
Some questions from the audience?
I guess it's safe to say that the developer base is constantly increasing, right? And are you under the impression that the code quality that of code that is contributed, not necessarily of code that makes it to the mainline, that the quality of code contributed is increasing or decreasing? Or are people getting better? The programmers, are they getting better or not?
In general, people are getting better. Some are very resistant to that, but The thing which overall may see that the code quality might as a whole not increase is that there are a lot of new contributors coming. And yeah, that's a challenge to deal with that. I'm thinking really of putting off a library of text blocks and to do the first review, because it's always the same, as often the same. I don't want to be mean about that. There are some unusual things in the kernel which you just have to learn. What really shows is that there's people working commercially on something, and they have deadlines. And some things feel really, really rushed. And if you say, sorry, no, please rewrite this, and then they go all wild and say, oh, no, we need that in the next version of the kernel, and then you have to have the standing and say, no, I know it's an important chip for you and you really want that, but sorry, that doesn't meet our criteria, so no chance.
There's still time. Oh, there's one more question.
So what we see we have more and more Linux devices. So even the normal user has Linux devices, Linux TV from Samsung. Most of them are Linux handies, which are labeled Android. So the routers normally are Linux. So given the number of devices, the visibility of the Linux or the GNU Linux system as a label is not so much for the normal user. So wouldn't it be better to have this thing more branded, that everybody knows Android is not mainly invented by Google, it only has been repackaged Linux plus some Java code on top of it? Or wouldn't it be better if Samsung has to announce all our devices are Linux devices and we have wonderful 3D TVs, but the core is a Linux device? What do you think about the visibility of Linux as a brand? For example, when Steve Jobs died, everybody cried on this planet, I had the impression, but Dennis Ritchie died 2 weeks later, was much more important, and nobody cared about it.
Simple question.
Do I really want to be blamed for every Android bug?
There's no way. I mean, the only way to get people actually show that there's Linux inside, like the Intel logo, right, is to change the license. And you can't change the license of Linux kernel. It doesn't work.
And most users outside the development area don't really care what's inside as long as it works. One would need to think, what is the gain of that? I think it would be better if that would be around, but it would require a lot of energy, which I wonder if it's spent into making Linux the best operating system in the world, then the rest might come automatically. Start hiding and then we'll be there and you can't avoid us or something like that.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. Because of the GPL license, there must be some hint at least that Linux is in it. No? Because it's given to the end user?
Sure, you can always just put a note in your handbook that nobody reads.
Yeah, that's true. But so at least somewhere there's a little hint, normally, that there's actually Linux in it.
Usually there is. And if not, it's an infliction, infringement, whatever, violation of the license. Yeah. But there usually you find one somewhere along the all the other texts that you never would end up reading.
But I still think that most users actually don't care. I mean, I did much work in the embedded range. And in the embedded area at the moment in Germany, 80% of all newly started embedded projects are done with Linux. I would really make a bet that at least in almost every household in Germany, there's at least one Linux computer, in a DVD player or a navigation system or a mobile phone or whatever. DSL routers. Linux is very scalable and can run on any on many architectures and for many applications, starting from very small embedded devices to large server clusters, the kernel now supports how much? 15 architectures? How many do we have? Lots. Okay, but what the normal user on the street, what they see is one application, a desktop or a laptop or something like that, one architecture, x86, and that's it. That's what they see is that is a computer. Everything else is not a computer. Most people don't even know what an operating system is. They say I start my Windows when in fact they start Word, for example, or something like that, and they mix it up and it makes no difference. So it's difficult to explain that there is an operating system in their DVD player. That is a much too technical point of view for most, and they don't care, and especially they don't care if it's Linux or anything else.
Getting closer to six, maybe two final questions. There were lots of Android drivers that were recently merged into the staging tree, but the Android kernel and the mainline kernel still are different in some parts. Is that a problem, or is it just like the world is sometimes, and we all deal with it. Any opinion on that?
You will always have forks. That's completely unavoidable. And as long as people are actually interested in working on getting things merged back again, it's all fine. I mean, there's no way around having a fork, because the only way to actually innovate is to fork. Even if the fork is only for 2 days in your local branch, you're still doing a fork, right, essentially. And so the same thing goes with Android. They're trying the thing out for us. They're doing all the QA for us.
Has it grown too big, the fork? Has it maybe grown too big, the fork?
It is a pretty big fork, and it's a pretty scary fork, especially since it got more users than all of the rest of Linux. But it's still, the whole concept is not bad in its entirety. So having not everything in mainline does not necessarily hurt us, as long as the main consensus is that things should go back.
I think Android is probably the most often used Linux distribution today. And since they maintain their own kernel fork, we have to take care that this fork doesn't become more important than the original mainline Linux. And therefore, it is important to merge these two forks together, or to keep them close together, so that not at some point in time that the Android kernel is the real Linux kernel, and the other thing that Linux maintains becomes somewhat unimportant.
Maybe the final question then is there one from the audience?
Issue. Do you personally know people from Google, and do you try to encourage them to merge back their code?
I personally don't know people working on Android themselves, so I can't encourage anybody.
From what I heard, experienced. They are interested in working with mainline, but there's also the deadline problem, or we need a solution now problem they have, and Google is big enough. So if they I think also they have a good feeling, okay, we need a solution now. The true right, the way to do it right would be take us so much time, we don't have that, so we just roll our own. This is partly happening, but the developers I met were definitely interested in working with the community, and I think if we really have a good, close eye, what is that part which is Google running on their own and which is the part which could lead to some well-maintainable code, then I hope we have some consensus.
Another example from Google is not Android, but Chrome and Chromos. And one of the pieces of work they did there was a thing called Verity. That went upstream, I think, in the last merge window or the one before, DM Verity. That is about trusted boot on the laptops that they're shipping.
Just one small remark regarding the kernel space of Android. I didn't do any formal analysis or so, but I just had a quick look on the current patch between the Google tree and the mainline tree, and I think it's a bunch of very special hacks to ARM drivers and so, but I didn't notice too much mainline diff in the current Google tree, but I didn't look through it, so perhaps you have a clearer picture here, but I think the difference isn't that big anymore between the Google fork and the mainline kernel. This was my impression. I think most things already went upstream from Google in the staging tree.
You can make a large difference with just 5 lines of code.
Sure. I think it's getting smaller, so I think the message was received.
Yeah. And there are other examples from the systems that Google run internally on their own servers. They have highly customized kernels. It would save them a lot of maintenance work if they could get those features upstream. But they are necessarily very custom features for Google. And in a number of cases, upstream doesn't want the features. So they have to maintain them themselves. But they'll be only too happy to send those changes upstream. Examples like if the kernel crashes on one of the servers, they can trace it right back to what the user was doing that caused the crash. They've got complete traceability through the log, or so I'm told. So they can trace it back to, oh, that Gmail user did that, and that caused this particular kernel crash. But to do that, you have to have instrumented logging all the way through the stack. And that's something that, so far, the kernel community hasn't wanted to take. People at Google are in the kernel community. They're talking about these things. But as a whole, it's not something that we're wanting to put in.
A quick remark about staging, about Android drivers being in staging. I personally wouldn't call drivers which are in the staging area in the kernel. It's more like, help, I want to be in the kernel, please help me.
So maybe the final question for all of you, Robert, maybe you could start. If you could snip your fingers and improve something in the kernel somewhere, something that annoys you, what would you improve? And it can be much work, it just would automatically happen by snipping your fingers. Power management, locking, graphics drivers, there must be something. Make the AMD port faster.
Yeah, I think it's already in a good shape, but
something in the user space you would like to see?
Yeah, it would be. I see that this tools directory in the kernel tree, and I actually don't like this that much. So. If that could be separated, that would be my wish, at least, or it's something. But this is often discussed, or question on the mailing list, and I think we now can all also live with that, but yeah, I personally wouldn't do that that way, mixing kernel code and tools code. So, yeah, but the main reason I think is that if you tie it with too much, you don't have to be fixed APIs anymore, or you don't need these interfaces with fixed ones. So it's much more easier to change these interfaces and other tools that are not in that repository. Yeah, the interface breaks when and the tool has to be changed. So, yeah, this is what I would change. So,
if somebody could show me how to play a Blu-ray disc, that would be cool.
I would wish me better support for huge pages. We currently have transparent huge pages, but they are very x86 specific and only cover anonymous memory, and I think other operating systems are better at this, and we should also, and this should also be better in Linux, I think.
Well, I'd really like to do this here, and the real-time preemption patch is in mainline. it'll be in mainline by the end of the year. We all don't know in which year, because they say that they use that sentence since 7 or 8 years, I think. So it's yeah, and for people who need it, and that's really not a nice thing, and I think there would even be much more users of the real-time kernel if it were in mainline, and you could just make one switch and you have a real-time kernel. It's also interesting for example for the audio people or something like that. I even used it on a normal desktop for a while, and it's a nice experience.
I'd like to have the device driver initialization cleaned up, because if you have a device you want to support, it has usually some memory region where the registers are, and so you have an IRQ and maybe some DMR memory too, and it's very tedious to initialize that, or get the information where that is, request, get the next information, request, oh, there's an error, so you have to free the resources you have gained, and people often forget that and take wrong error path, and there are lots of errors in that part of the code, and nobody really likes to write it. So some magic way to put it more like in a structure and have that handled by the kernel, so nobody can forget to free some resources or whatever, that would be nice, and would make the driver directory a lot smaller and better to easier to maintain.
If I could just snap and have something done, I would actually it's partially coming true, and would really like to have a proper user space IO framework that also doesn't only work on PCI, but on every single, even the sysbus devices on the world, that you would just ask and it would give you a device tree blob that would just automatically work for that device with the configuration that you want to have, just so it would not just be, again, something x86 specific, but would just work anywhere you like, and you could just have virtualization with pass-through work wherever.
Well, I think I'd like to look at all the implicit knowledge that kernel developers have in their head about not using locks in particular ways. You can use them this way, but not that way. Don't do that. Take all those rules, take. There's an existing thing called check patch, and basically, I'd like fix patch.
And nice closing words. Thanks for answering the questions. Thanks for the questions from the audience. I hope you enjoyed the kernel track and the kernel questioning. I'm sure next year there will be a kernel track as well on the Linux talk, and maybe a questioning as well. So maybe we see each other again here next year. Thanks, everybody.